Welcome. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy because now everybody has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest today is Paul Glover from paulglover.org. Paul, are you there? Welcome to the program.
Hi, Vinny.
How are you, my friend?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Somewhat fabulous is my standard response.
Considering, yes.
Yes.
The world we live in.
Well, I don't know. How about where we start is we get you to explain to the audience and, of course, myself, just a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Well, you've invited me on the show, I think, because I've taken a number of initiatives over the many years on behalf proving that ecology and social justice are practical priorities for society. I've started organizations, about 18 organizations and campaigns that transfer control over food, fuel, housing, healthcare, planning, education, transportation, and finance to grassroots entities and decentralize authority on behalf of community and nature. Among these are Ithaca Hours, a local currency that started 22 years ago that has transacted millions of dollars of value in that small city. It's currency that I designed on my computer and spent the next several years convincing people in the community, several thousand individuals and over 500 businesses, that it was real money. And we've made grants to over 100 community organizations and loans up to $30,000 without charging interest. I started a health co-op for the uninsured in Ithaca. As you know, in the United States is not altogether a civilized nation. People have to pay for access to health care out of pocket or through the paycheck in considerable amounts. So did those in Ithaca and have moved since then to Philadelphia, a rust belt city with 350,000 unemployed, 275,000 uninsured with no health access, 60,000 chronically hungry children, 40,000 vacant lots, and is the world capital of incarceration with the highest rate of incarceration of all cities in the world. It's hog heaven for an urban ecologist, and that is my field, to translate, to weave nature back into cities.
Okay. And are you by chance advocating any form of, shall we say, rigid governmental change, you know, like getting, how can I say this? Getting the federal government out of people's lives and instead getting volunteers to start doing the work that the government's kind of doing by itself at the moment.
Oh, indeed. To the extent that we take responsibility and control within our communities and within our regions, we decrease our dependence on national and global entities for providing us with the necessities of everyday life, and they are not doing a very good job of that. So the need is evident to more and more people every day. In the United States, there are millions of organizations which are seeking to do exactly this. And these organizations, these entities, these initiatives, both for-profit and especially non-profit, create what I consider a mutual enterprise economy, which is neither strictly capitalist nor strictly socialist, kind of anarchist, but within government of necessity, that meet needs without depending on distant boardrooms or distant legislatures. An immense amount of activity of this sort is evident in Philadelphia and very proud to be part of this range of efforts here. But again, as, throughout the globe, there are plenty of initiatives that prove the practicability of grassroots control of everyday life.
Now, can I ask as well, the other elements is that there's, I feel, there's two green movements now. There's the real green movement that actually wants to take whatever we've got and simply make it less harmful and more sustainable, and the other green movement who think that any form of pollution or any form of encroachment on nature is evil and people need to be enslaved and contained in hardcore super sustainable cities and have all their freedoms and rights taken off them.
I don't think that they're mutually exclusive. I drafted a scenario about 30 years ago for Los Angeles. I went there because it was the worst case. The triumphant consumerism, America, we pave, we go fast, we throw things away. This is America. I went there deliberately because Los Angeles had achieved that pinnacle and was the broadcast to the world of that standard of living to prove that there was a different pathway. And that green pathway would enable us to retain our independence as individuals by rebuilding the city entirely over many decades toward balance with nature. I wrote a book titled Los Angeles, A History of the Future. And America desperately needs ideas and images of a new pathway beyond what seems to be, for more and more people, a dead end in this country. Our idea of progress and growth, of success and a good life, has been broadcast throughout the world and is replicated woefully extensively. So my book described a process by which over, as I say, many decades, we could employ everyone in what are known as green jobs to rebuild the city so that it needed virtually no fossil fuel, so that it produced within the region nearly all of its food and fuel, and in which people had the greatest autonomy and the greatest creativity in job development. That is to say, instead of working in cubicles for companies remote from us and our needs, we were creating for one another. Those things which were beautiful to us and a delight to trade with one.
Well, can I also say that the main ethos, I think, about any form of government tends to be about making sure that people are accepting of the changes rather than simply being pushed or forced into it. And if they won't accept, they can opt out, sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah. Voluntary associations are the essence of the anarchism, the kind of anarchism that I have promoted, the voluntary organizations that appeal to people, saying we can do it better together. Your beauty and your creativity can combine in such a way as to meet our needs with least overhead, with least bureaucracy. And to me that is the best idea of a good economy and a good society. Our marketplaces are real places where we meet each other as friends and lovers and political allies, rather than global abstractions where we trade digits, literally at the speed of light, without any regard for the effect of that transaction, those transactions on ecology, on the planet. or on community. And I started the local currency Ithaca Hours in 1991 deliberately to transfer control over money and what money does to the community, entirely to expand that part of the marketplace, which was a genuine geographic place, that enabled us to become a community, to create community, to make a living while making a community. And that was very successful for many years. It needs a renewal, a networking process, a very intensive network process to reinflate it to its peak capacity. And as I mentioned, in the United States, we don't have a national health plan. Everybody has to scramble and pay out a big part of their paycheck if they have enough for health care, and in this country, 50 million do not. I started a renegade health plan. People paid $100 per year, and they could use Ithaca Hours, local currency, as part of that, to own and control a health plan, which provided them, to the extent we developed it, for 12 categories of everyday emergency anywhere in the world to specified maximum amounts, and today they own their own pre-clinic. That component of ownership is very important. We do not depend and wait around for the goodness of government, nor for the generosity of the corporate state.
I would say that if you are waiting around for the government to become good and the corporations to become generous, you'd be waiting a very long time.
We are both speaking ironically.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, indeed. The process of taking control locally and regionally requires of us all responsibility. That is to say, it is fairly easier to critique and condemn the capital they who are greedy and violent and corrupt. They are all over the place. They are, since human society began, there has always been they who are greedy, corrupt, and violent. But to assert our responsibility and capability to be a generous and loving counterpart to them is a great challenge to us all, and a challenge that I have welcomed. And that millions are actively engaged in worldwide.
Do you think any of these people in the government or the banking industry might be a little unhappy about what you're doing and basically encouraging people to take personal responsibility as opposed to being encouraged to be dependent on companies and governments that they basically have no control over, including the legislature?
Well, it's been curious that the local currency that I started, as I say, that had transacted millions of dollars value, was never challenged by the government, and in fact was endorsed by the government. Now, I explained to them that, in fact, the national economies and the national currencies, which are all backed by debt, it depends for their vitality on the vitality of village, neighborhood, and urban economies. For some reason, they never shut us down. I assumed it was illegal, which was part of the fun, but they never did. When I started the health co-op, though, because there is a monopoly on health insurance in this country, they did try to shut us down, and we growled at each other for a year and a half, and I finally made a threat to them, which was nonviolent and legal but terrifying to them, and they backed down. I threatened to run for governor of New York State on the Green Party line, and gaining 50,000 votes would have gained for us permanent ballot status, which would have meant we could have tilted the balance of power from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. We would have spoiled their election. You can't spoil something that's rotten, but we would have spoiled the Democratic majority in New York State, and they were scared of that, so they backed down. At any rate, indeed, there is an extent to which within government there are people who, as bureaucrats, are dull and clueless, and also among them people who are excited to do something different and who share our values, though they are in government. So I look around for the doors that are ready to crack open. But I do not wait around or expect or depend on their generosity and open-mindedness. I've written a book titled How to Take Power. I've written several books. That's one of them.
Well, hold on. We've come into break now, Paul. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Paul Glover. His website is paulglover.org. Back in a minute. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We do a public service of basically interviewing anybody you listeners ask for. Somebody asked for Paul Glover, so we've got him on here at paulglover.org. Paul, welcome back.
Hello, Vinnie.
See, here's the great thing that I like about you is that you really come in at this green angle from an angle that I like and I think is actually quite brilliant, really. Is because you're cutting through the bureaucracy, cutting through the BS, and simply solving the problems person by person, neighborhood by neighborhood. You know, if you do a whole lot of small things, they add up to a lot.
The intent is to set examples, to create models that prove the practicability of local control, of grassroots control, that bring forward the beauty and creativity of average people. Rather than dependence, ownership, and I think that attitude and the proof of the capability that we each have, and collaboratively that we have, is the essence and foundation of a society which is healthy. My broadest aim. And that which gets me up in the morning is that cities, particularly, become as beautiful as the children within them. Cities are full of beautiful children, and they deserve cities as beautiful as they are. I haven't been to Auckland. There are a lot of places that I have not been, cities which are beautiful. And I mean beautiful not only in the sense of lovely architecture and flowers, but I mean in the sense of being ecologically sustainable, that engage the capability of each and every person. And American cities outstandingly have become cities which are dedicated more to consumerism than to creating.
And do you feel that if people don't have that sort of that creation, that community involvement in their life, that there's really personal nasty consequences, like turning to crime, drugs, something of that nature?
Oh, indeed. That the purpose of life to me is that creativity be released and celebrated. And our contemporary cultures, our contemporary media in general, celebrate a few funny people, a few artistic people. And put the rest of us in shade to merely be entertained. And I look forward to that, and to the development, to the redevelop of a civilization and a society that engage that beauty and creativity, not just to entertain, but to inspire and activate the rebuilding of society so that it does not depend on the consumption of the essential resources of nature, but replenishes nature and is beautiful at the same time. It's all order, but I think nothing less is required and expected of us on behalf of the next generation. So for me, life is not about how much I can buy going shopping. It is about how much I can help and foster, create on behalf of indefinite future generations. To me, that is much more central to the purpose of life. And a glorious, if I can use that word, national project. I mentioned that the United States has been so outstandingly effective at distributing a culture globally, the standards of success that have been adopted so vastly. We need to broadcast from our country a new standard of success, which is that creativity, not how much, as I say, we can buy, how much we can create.
Can I ask as well, your personal story and coming through all this, you've been active in these sorts of areas and community activism, creating green jobs. We've got the Patch Adams Health Care Clinic here. You've basically got a long list of things that you've done. I'm wondering how you grew up and what got you started being interested in all of this. Like, what did your parents do?
Well, I was raised in a very standard manner in the suburbs of an American city, and had no worries about food, had no worries about anything. And the Vietnam War came along and snapped a lot of us to attention and required of us to engage history, that is to say, to justify whether we would or would not participate in the expansion of an American empire. And the challenge was raised to us, if you are so against this war and this empire, what are you for? And so I have been, since then, very active in defining what I was for. I was raised close to nature, and that beauty of nature, and the desire that everyone and every child particularly enjoy connection with that beauty of nature has stayed with me. And I do not know why it has been so tenacious within me that all problems can be solved. If they can't be solved, well, then we might as well just all die. And I have instead insisted that they can all be solved. And I have sought to prove that. And as I said at the very beginning, millions of organizations, initiatives, worldwide, are proving the practicability of alternatives. They are not headline news. They are not front page. But they are happening. The world is getting better at the same time that it's getting worse.
Yeah, that's my philosophy. Everything gets better and worse at the same time. I mean, what was it? There was an early lesson in geography, actually. You know how waves come and dump on the beach and they take out sand and stuff like that, yet somehow more sand comes back. And it's called dynamic equilibrium. It doesn't matter how big the process of destruction is going, there's always a process of creation going on just underneath it that replaces it and keeps everything in balance. And I'm coming to the conclusion now that humanity's sort of becoming conscious of their own part to play in this dynamic equilibrium and are deciding to become the force of creation rather than the force of destruction that's happening right now
and using intense creativity to accomplish these things. I just read this morning that there is a crowdsourcing project for a guy who's created a rather large vessel, or the plans for one anyway, that has enormous catchment booms on the sides of it, and they want to clean up the world's oceans of all that soupy type plastic that's basically wobbling around out there in 5 years. And I thought, man, what a brilliant idea, because I've seen how much waste has been dumped into the oceans at a point where you can dunk a small fishing net in the water in the middle of the ocean and pick up little chunks of plastic. It's horrific. And yet now we've got the ability and the inclination to change it. It's the same thing, isn't it?
Indeed. There are historic cycles where things get worse and things get better, where people suffer horrid indignities and devastation, and then they rebel against those. They have revolutions, sometimes which redress the problems or which replace the people at the top. And the technologies are being invented. Amazing, beautiful things are happening. And that the challenge is that they become ascendant. And that is an age-old question. That is, within every society, there are people who want to control and dominate and will seek to do so regardless of the damage and doom that they inflict on society, notwithstanding that they themselves will be consumed in the inevitable ensuing revolution. So, to smooth out that cycle of devastation and revolution, to foster nonviolent social change, these technologies knock on the door and say, we can do the job. And some of them are green jobs, green technologies. Some of them are deep green jobs. And I distinguish between these, between green jobs and deep green jobs. Green jobs kind of palliate and reduce the damage done, the extent of it, while the damage continues. And the deep green jobs entirely replace the damage that is done. And that's why I return to this theme of creating rather than consuming. We are raised to believe that our destiny and our definition of success personally is the extent to which we can buy stuff. I personally own nothing. I do have a laptop and a bicycle, but I have made a deliberate decision a long time ago to own nothing. I have enough clothes to be legal and to not smell bad. But it has been far more exciting to me to participate in and initiate social organizations that prove the practicability of human compatibility with the planet Earth. So, yes, sir, yes, it's been a lot of fun.
And your personal journey of all of this, you must have seen some amazing sort of examples of humanity out there. Who were some of the people you admire?
Well, there are famous people I admire. Gosh, in the United States, Ralph Nader, Thoreau, and yes, a good range of famous people. But I admire people who are raising families or living a life of reasonable and modest material dignity while at the same time putting main effort and maintaining a faith in the capability of people to create communities that are compatible with nature, and in which everybody has an equal chance at a life of dignity.
Well, it seems that dignity around the United States seems to be getting taken away at every look and turn, isn't it? I mean, isn't that what the TSA is about? To take away your dignity?
Oh, and your breast milk? Yeah. It's a recurring historic cycle. We've seen this whenever there has been a challenge to the prevailing authority. They have whipped the public into a frenzy of acceptance of tyranny, whether it has been anarchists, communists, socialists, terrorists. And that is a prevailing idea in the United States at this time. At the same time, there's a huge amount of pushback. People are aware, because they are aware of the history of what are known as false flags, that the government will capitalize, will take advantage of violence within the country to clamp down on civil liberties. So, that's happening. But it's happened before. It's a recurring cycle. And I think that is very important to me. Among other things, I have written urban histories, and I have an understanding of the broad cycles of history. And that sustains me as well, that bad things happen, they become a sense, and then they are pushed back. And
are you following, by chance, examples that have happened throughout history of how to push back tyranny or social degradation? Or are you creating a whole new one?
That's a very good question. The intent is to learn as many lessons of history as one may in order to create examples which most effectively moderate, decrease the extreme cycle of oppression and revolution. So, I have focused on the idea that people in general can and should control money and land and law, and how we may, in the midst of the worst domination and oppression and degradation, take that control back again.
All right, and we'll be right back from break in a minute.
Look at me, driving and I won't stop. And it feels so good to be alive and on top. My reach is global, my tower secure. My cause is noble, my power is pure. I can hand out a million vaccinations, or let them all die in exasperation. Have them all healed from lacerations, have them all killed by assassination.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live 5 days a week on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. You, the listeners, are the fuel for this show, and I'm simply the man behind the curtain, pulling all the levers and making the flame shoot out and stuff. A very special guest is Paul Glover from paulglover.org. And I wanted you to actually finish up. I asked you before the break about whether or not you're copying other historical examples of what has worked throughout history to oppose tyranny and environmental degradation and applying it to today, or whether you're coming up with entirely new systems based upon our new understanding in the current world. Paul, are you there? Seem to have lost him. That's great. Okay. Well, while we're busy getting him up, there's something else that I wanted to remind people of, as well as the fact that I'm just kind of working really hard now to get these new types of Vinnie Eastwood Show videos up on the YouTube channel. We're using a little HD camera filming during the show each day and popping in the pictures of the guests as well, and I hope people really appreciate and enjoy that. It takes like about twice as long as the older versions, which are a bit lower quality, but yeah, it's pretty cool, man. I reckon if you got technology, freaking use it, you know, add some value to it. Speaking of value, we're in real financial trouble here in the homestead of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Next week's rent, I don't think we're going to be able to afford it. So if there's anybody else out there with $5 a month they could spare, and go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, subscribe, give us a monthly donation. So that way, if we've got a regular income from the listeners that we serve on this show, we'll basically keep going forever and ever and continue to produce some high quality and highly entertaining content for you. And we very much appreciate all of the donations and subscriptions that have come in thus far. I do recall that we had a big problem with PayPal that kind of wiped me out, and I'm still wiped out because of it. Many of the people who used to be subscribers to the show for between $1 and $20 a month all had to cancel their subscriptions because that old account wasn't working. That was under the infectiousfilms@gmail.com email. That one's no longer active. I won't be able to access any of the funds in that for another 180 days. The new PayPal is gorillamedia911@gmail.com. That's the PayPal one there. So if you could have a check back. If you were a subscriber in the past, and I think there was about 90 of you that cancelled when we had these PayPal problems, so you're still listening to the show, but very few of those people have actually resubscribed. So I'm doing a very specific call out to you. If you have previously been a subscriber to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, thank you very much for doing so and continue to enjoy those ad-free archives. And if you have not resubscribed, please do, because we need those subscriptions and donations right now to pay the rent next week. It's a real frustrating scenario, and of course, I know everybody else feels this way from time to time. You just don't know how you're going to get through the next week, and that's how I'm going right now. It's pretty harsh, so any support would be very, very much greatly appreciated. Okay, now, American Freedom Radio, are we getting Paul Glover back up soon by any chance? Is he there? No? Okay. Well, let's try and get him back up. I don't think the studio is responding. I know everybody can hear me. So, all right. Now, the other element. Oh, wait. Here we are. Paul, are you back?
Hey.
All right. What happened there?
I don't know.
Oh, well, it's inconsequential.
Satellite.
Anyway, getting on to it, there was a question I asked you before the break about all these historical instances that have happened where people kind of get used to and start demanding tyranny, and then eventually that tyranny gets overthrown by somebody somehow. And I presume in the past, environmental degradation has really come into it as well. You know, the environment being destroyed through war or the salting of fields and things of that nature under the Romans. And I was just wondering, are you coming up with all new methodologies for reversing these very simple and commonly reoccurring historical symptoms, or are you basically updating previous methodologies that have worked to overthrow tyranny and restore the environment in the past?
Yes, I mentioned that my initiatives are, of course, based on historic precedent, but tweak it and to create novelties for our time. More broadly, I think that we have developed a middle-class idea and an ideal of success, personal achievement, and the good life, which are counterproductive. And so I have written an article titled From the Middle Class to the Mutual Class. The middle class has become more concerned with its properties than its liberties, has become more preoccupied with consuming, creating. And a mutual class gets off of the treadmill of dependence on banks and shopping malls and mortgages and student loans by creating non-profit, genuinely non-profit alternatives to all of these. And food, of course, as well. That through these processes, we become autonomous again. We become communities again, which are least dependent on external supplies, least dependent on external authorities for the meeting of our basic needs. Yes, historic precedent. In the United States, 100 years ago, a third of American households were members of fraternal benefit organizations, mutual aid organizations. And they paid pennies a week to be members, to be owners of health cooperatives, which created their own hospitals, orphanages, old folks' homes, sanitaria, and which paid sickness and death benefits. So I have sought to rekindle that heritage in the United States, but have confronted authority, which seeks to maintain a monopoly, a corporate monopoly, on the provision of those basic services. And as I said before, that's part of the fun.
I've had this inkling here while we've been having this conversation that anybody who tries to maintain a status quo must be pretty nuts, really. It can't be maintained. No, nothing stays the same for too long, does it?
As the capitalist J.P. Morgan once said, I can employ half of the working class to kill the other half. And so you have
bureaucracies.
Yes?
What a psychopath.
Yes. And you have bureaucracies whose employees are committed to being middle class, who are dependent on banks for mortgages, for car loans, for health insurance, for student loans. They must have that income, even though when they go to work, they might know that they are part of the problem. The creating of pathways of alternatives is an essential part of the process of getting us all off that treadmill. The millions of people who depend on corporate incomes to do bad things must be assured that when they let go, that there is something else available. I've often characterized this as being like on a sinking ship. And the last people, the people are climbing the mast to be the last ones to sink. And they're kicking the people down below them on the mast so that they can be the last ones to sink. That's capitalism at its absolute worst. If you create a lifeboat, if you build a lifeboat and throw a line, then you know you don't need to kick each other. You don't need to compete to be the last one standing. But together, we can live. It's a very old story in human civilization. Competition and cooperation. Polarity, and defined within those polarities a society which enables us to be individualistic and competitive at the same time to thrive by cooperating. That is our essential challenge, I think. And the mutual enterprise society that I have promoted, I call it mutual enterprise, that is to say, neither strictly capitalistic, nor strictly socialistic, but a mutual enterprise society which celebrates...
That celebrates
enterprise,
what?
Initiative and creativity which serves community and nature.
Indeed. Well, I think that's a nice positive place to leave it, and gives you a rough general outline of the things that you're doing. So if you are in Philadelphia, ladies and gentlemen, hey, get in contact with Paul. His phone number's on his website there, paulglover.org. Paul, thank you very much for coming on the show today, man. It's been awesome.
Thank you, Vinny. Good to talk with you, too.
All right. And after the break, ladies and gentlemen, we will have a new guest coming at us for your listening pleasure as well, named Svi Maisanai, which should be talking about, I think, maybe Indonesian independence. I don't know. We'll find out. Back in a minute.